everyone. I'm Gary Null. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week at this time, we take a series of events that have occurred around the world that I believe are not receiving the kind of objective and fair-minded insight that they deserve. These deal with a wide variety of topics. We have been doing this now for more than 12 years every week, so we've covered a lot. Today, we're going to cover different things. You'll be hearing about Wi-Fi, microwaves, and the consequences to our health. We'll have people such as Barry Trower, a British physicist who is a microwave weapons expert, and who worked for the Royal Navy and the British Secret Service. He talks on the record about the health effects of Wi-Fi and other forms of microwave radiation. And now you look at the average teenager, look at the average adult. Every hotel room you go in, they have Wi-Fi. In cars, every cab you get in, they suddenly start to play that little ABC or NBC clips. That's through Wi-Fi. You have to get that signal into the cab. That means the entire cab and everyone in it's being irradiated with this pulsed magnetic frequency that can disrupt our chemistry. Let's say you live in a building that has, the cell phone tower, which it frequently does. You're going to be exposed. So we're living in a sea of pulsed therapies, and these are completely disadvantageous to our health. So we're going to deal with that. And he is a person from the inside of that. So he can help explain from the beginning. Then we're going to go to Seattle, where in a town hall meeting, Chris Hedges is explaining in only the way that Chris Hedges can how we have become a rogue nation, the ultimate fascist state in the world, a police state with imperial overdrive ambitions. This is not the type of talk you hear people give, and that's why it's at a town meeting. Now let's hear what one of the world's leading authorities on the dangers of microwave radiation and his own story, telling us how he became aware of this and what they found and the fact that they actually were weaponizing this. So they can't get away with the idea, we didn't know this was dangerous. Yes, you did. You actually planned on using this against other nations and peoples. You knew exactly what this would do. Here now is an expert on the topic.
Joined the Royal Navy in 1960, and I specialized in microwave warfare. Radar, obviously, which uses microwave, but they don't just teach you radar, they teach you all about microwaves and other uses. So I understood about microwave warfare and how it can damage people, how it can harm people. And when I finished with the Royal Navy, I was also a diver in the Royal Navy, and microwaves are used in underwater mines as booby traps. Which actually got me interested, because I was actually taking a bomb to pieces underwater, and it was too complicated. And I brought it to the surface, and my partner that was on the surface said, "Don't be an idiot, take it back down." He said, "If somebody's beaming you with microwaves, they'll go right through you, and as you open the casing, trigger a photoelectric cell, and it'll blow all of us up." And he said, "If it doesn't go through to the bomb, it'll aim it at your head and make you make a mistake." And that's really got me interested from that point, because I thought, well, how can microwaves going into your brain make you make a mistake? And I asked a lot of questions. I have a very curious brain. And the forces, they're very good at explaining things and telling you things. So I did that, and I also did a medical course while I was in to help me understand everything. And when I left, a small part of my job was to question captured agents, spies, terrorists, because microwaves then were used as weapons, as they are today. It is a perfect stealth weapon. And when governments don't like a group of people, for instance, the ladies who protest at Greenham Common in England about the American missile base they camped, they were microwaved. We microwaved Catholics in Northern Ireland to make them sick. It goes on all over the world. And it's a weapon that you don't know you're being targeted because the dose is very, very low, which is actually more dangerous than a high dose. It's very, very low, and it may take a year or two, but you can cause neurological damage and cancers with low-level microwaves, and you can make all your opponents sick. It's a perfect weapon for a government to use. So that was going on, and I gathered all the information about that from people who were captured from other countries to find out what technologies they had, what pulse frequencies they used. But as I stressed, it was only a small part of my work, but because I was highly trained in it and I was useful, it just became a part of my working structure, along with master criminals and terrorists and all sorts of people that I found incredibly interesting, actually, to talk to. Very, very interesting. And then when I left there, I took a job teaching, and I taught advanced level physics, and I specialised in nuclear and atomic radiation, and again microwaves. And I've just always been in microwaves. And then it was a doctor. I went to see a doctor once, as most teachers do, with a sore throat. And he said, as most doctors do, it's viral, there's nothing I can do for you. And I was leaving. And he said, hang on, Barry, he said, you're a physicist. And I said, yeah. And he said, can you explain something? He said, I went to a house that had a cot death 5 years ago. And the family moved, and a new family moved in. They had a new baby. The cot was in exactly the same place. And there was another cot death. And he said, 5 years apart. And he said, there's a transmitter the other side of the child's bedroom wall. Could the transmitter cause the cot death? And I said, I don't know. I said, but I'll look into it. And then I found that microwaves were involved, and I knew what microwaves did. And a while later, I went back to the doctor, I wrote a paper on it, and I said, there's your answer. Microwaves can cause cot death by two or three different mechanisms. There's your answer. And then, for some reason, he told somebody who told somebody, and people started phoning me up and writing to me, saying, can you explain this, or can you help with that? I've never actually asked anyone if I can do anything. They always come to me. And then the police came to me and said, we're getting this new Tetra airwave system. We don't understand what's happening. Can you read all this scientific rubbish and just put it into Janet and John and tell us? And I said, of course I can. So that was published, and since then it's snowballed and snowballed and snowballed, and now I receive up to 1,000 communiques a week from various countries, various people, and I can't handle it. So, and I'm here now because somebody asked me to come here. I think anyone who puts Wi-Fi into a school should be locked up for the rest of their life. I really do. I think they're not fit to walk on the surface of this planet because they haven't looked at the research, and whatever incentive they have, it is not worth the genetic problems that parents are going to face with their children when they're born. And if you think of a single parent, a mother, who has a genetically deformed child, that particular mother will feel guilty because she gave birth. She will feel guilty and she will be worried every single second of every single day for her life. She will worry that the child won't marry. If the child can marry, she'll worry that the children will carry the disease, which they will. She will worry when she dies, who will take care of them. So you are condemning both the family and the children to a lifetime of absolute hell. And this is already published. It is available to look up. It's what I call intentional ignorance. They are offered some sort of incentive, and they think, oh, this is going to be good, we'll have it. Now, the problem is, imagine you are a 15-year-old schoolgirl. All of the 400,000 eggs in your ovaries were with you at birth. They're not fully developed, but they're with you. They are 10 times more susceptible to radiation than all of the other DNA in the body. And scientists don't realize that. They don't read all of the papers as I do. So you have this highly susceptible genetic material which is going to make your children. And you are irradiating it because Wi-Fis, they are transmitters as well as the routers, as well as the ones either side of you. They are all transmitting at this height through your ovaries. So you are risking the damage, the DNA damage, of your child every time you sit down and you use Wi-Fi. And it's like saying, if I smoke a cigarette, which one will cause the damage? The answer is, I don't know. It could be the one today. So you now have a child that has a probability of being genetically damaged. But the real damage is when that child grows up. You have genetic material in your ovaries which could be damaged. Now, the real problem comes, so you have a child that could be born genetically damaged, but the real problem comes when you become pregnant, if you are a teacher or a mature student and you become pregnant, because the embryo inside your womb, in the first 100 days, all of those 400,000 eggs are forming in your embryo, your child's ovaries. So your child could be born with genetically damaged eggs. And the main thing about the eggs in the ovaries of your child is that they have absolutely no protection. It hasn't been developed yet. We have a natural protection against microwaves. It was developed since the Stone Age against thunderstorms and massive amounts of radiation coming into our body. But in your embryo, your uterus, in the fetus, where your child is developing for the first 100 days, in the ovaries, the eggs do not have that protection. So they are at maximum risk from radiation. And for the first month or so, you wouldn't even know you were pregnant. You wouldn't even be taking precautions. That is the main danger area. So you give birth to a daughter, but her ovaries are now contaminated. She may be normal, she may be genetically damaged, but her ovaries are at the most risk. So when your daughter grows up and she becomes pregnant and has a baby, this is where one of these eggs will be fertilized and come out. So the real damage here is your grandchildren. That is where it is going to show most. And we already see this in animals that have reproductive cycles of a year or 2 years or 3 years. We're already seeing this, and it has been published by veterinary schools and vets and scientists. So we know this happens. And it's also been documented in the Cold War, when women were deliberately microwaved.
Imagine,
so we know it does
that
happen. The documents are there. And what you're risking by putting Wi-Fi into schools is the future generations of all of these girls. But it gets worse, because this particular DNA, the mitochondrial DNA inside you, and the DNA inside you, the mitochondrial DNA, you can trace unchanged to your mother, her mother, her mother, right the way back to the beginning of the human race in Africa, the Stone Age. You can trace your ancestors, if you could, right back to the very first lady. It is unchanged, the mitochondria. And that is being unchanged in your children, which means if you damage it, your child could be genetically damaged, then her child, and her child, and her child, forever. You are condemning the future generations of every single child until there are no more lines left in the female in your family. You must stop. A female must stop producing children for this to stop. So, when you put Wi-Fi in schools, what you're saying is, for the sake of a little bit of money that saves getting a workman in to drill holes through the walls to feed cable, because it's cheaper, we're just going to put Wi-Fi in, but you can have genetically damaged children for the rest of your family's career. That's what we're saying.
You've been listening to Mr. Barry, B-A-R-R-I-E, Trower, T-R-O-W-E-R, British physicist, the type of information that literally impacts every person. Now, he was specifically focusing upon the ovaries, reproductive health, and sudden infant death syndrome by the children who were living in the, they call it crib death. Now, imagine what that's doing, the cell phones, for example, to children's skulls, their brains, their chromosomes, and you see how serious this is. In a moment, we're going to hear from Chris Hedges at a town hall meeting in Seattle. Then we're going to have a brief excerpt from the 1981 film that accurately predicted the current state of our world. A clip from My Dinner with Andre makes some important observations. Then we're going to hear a very important segment from a Harvard-educated psychologist, Melanie Joy, about animal equality. I'm Gary Knoll. This program today, which is our Progressive Commentary Hour, normally we only do one theme with a panel of guests, but since I have been out of the loop of doing some live shows, and we've had to do some rebroadcasts because of being in transition to our new studio, I wanted to cover a lot of different topics, things that hopefully you'll find of importance. Let us now go to Chris Hedges at a town hall meeting in Seattle, Washington.
In the 2008 financial meltdown, constituent calls were 100-1 against the bailouts for the big banks and Wall Street across the political spectrum. And yet, that class of global speculators and speculation in Europe in the 17th century was a capital crime, and speculators were hung. Passed anyway. The infusion of corporate money into our elections, the rewriting of our Constitution by judicial fiat, twisting our form of legalized bribery into a justification for corporate cash, unlimited corporate cash, as being allowed under the Constitution as the right to petition the government, the refusal by the court system to challenge the evisceration of our privacy. We now are the most watched, monitored, photographed, eavesdropped population in human history. And I covered the Stasi state in East Germany during the revolution. The use of the Espionage Act to shut down whistleblowers, essentially extinguishing any serious investigations into the centers of power. Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which overturns over 150 years of domestic law and permits the U.S. military to seize American citizens who, quote-unquote, substantially support the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or something called associated forces, another nebulous term, strip them of due process and hold them in military facilities, in the words of that section, until the end of hostilities, which in an age of permanent war is a lifetime. And as some of you know, I sued Barack Obama in federal court over Section 1021 in the Southern District Court of New York, and we won, to the surprise of the Obama administration. And when Judge Catherine B. Forrest wrote her opinion after the ruling, she said that she struck down that law, she issued that temporary injunction, because it opened the way to criminalize an entire category of people. And she brought up the internment of 110,000 Japanese during World War II. The response of the Obama administration was chilling. Not just government attorneys, but attorneys for the NSA visited her chambers the day of her ruling and, in the name of national security, asked her to revoke her decision to lift the temporary injunction. And to her credit, she refused. That was a Friday afternoon. By 9 a.m. Monday morning, they were at the appellate court, the next highest court, the Second Circuit, demanding the same thing. And unfortunately, the Second Circuit agreed. And why? The lawyers and I wondered why. We knew they'd appeal, but why did they act that aggressively? And I think the only thing we could determine was that they're already using the law, most likely against U.S.-Pakistani dual nationals in places like Bagram. And if that injunction was allowed to stand, and if those U.S. citizens were able to escape captivity, they could hold the government in contempt of court. And how did the Second Circuit justify what is patently an unconstitutional misuse of the military as a domestic police force, empowering soldiers to carry out acts of extraordinary rendition on the streets of American cities? They did it the way the courts have been functioning, especially after 9/11. I was a plaintiff as well in Clapper versus Amnesty International, which before the Snowden revelations had challenged the FISA Amendment Act. And the government attorneys had reached the Supreme Court, told the court that the charge made by myself and the other plaintiffs that we were under surveillance was speculation, and then went on to say that if we were being watched by the government, we would be told. And believing the government attorneys, the Supreme Court denied our standing, our right to bring the case, and the Second Circuit, waiting for that ruling, turned around and said, if Hedges does not have standing as a plaintiff in Clapper versus Amnesty International, then he does not have a standing in Hedges versus Obama, and the case was thrown out. And it is law. And yet there, when they ran opinion polls on that section of the NDAA, it had a 97% disapproval rating, and it is law anyway. The TPP and CAFTA, which no one wants, the destruction of our TPID environmental regulations, what are left of them, the further disempowering of the American working class, trade agreements being rammed down our throats by corporations, and the specter of elected officials not being allowed to speak to us about what are in those agreements. Even if they take notes, when they leave the room, those notes are confiscated. Over and over, example after example, we see that we no longer count with the rise of a corporate oligarchic elite. Unfettered, unregulated capitalism has no internal constraints, and when you strip away the external constraints, it commodifies everything. Human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that it exploits until exhaustion or collapse. And that is why the assault on working men and women is intimately twinned with the assault on the ecosystem that sustains life itself. So this book asks something different. It begins from the belief that the mechanisms, including electoral politics, that once made reform possible, are irredeemably broken. And it calls for revolution. It calls for an overthrow of corporate power. It calls for acts of mass civil disobedience that disrupt forces that, if left unchecked, will extinguish all of the systems of life, including the natural world, that we depend on for existence. And what will that rebellion look like? I've covered war. I know violence. I fear it. I understand its poison. And yet, I am not a pacifist. I was in Sarajevo when it was being shelled by the Serbs, 2,000 shells a day, constant sniper fire, 4 to 5 dead a day, 2 dozen wounded a day. The city was surrounded by a trench system for 3.5 years, and we knew that if the Serb forces broke through those trenches, a third of the city would be murdered, and the rest would be driven into displacement and refugee camps. And that was not a supposition. It was what we had seen in the Drina Valley and in Vukovar. And at that point, when you are faced with forces bent on your own annihilation, you employ violence. There was no discussion in those basements under that siege about pacifism. And yet, the tragedy is that once you use violence, even for a purportedly just cause, you become contaminated by it. In wars that are about self-preservation, as that war in Bosnia was for the Muslim-led government, or in wars that are about overthrowing colonial occupiers, the War of Independence in Algeria, the war in Vietnam, the wars being waged in Iraq and Afghanistan. Violence has an efficacy that can work. But revolution is different. And we speak about the American Revolution, but that's a misnomer. The American struggle was the overthrowing of a colonial occupier at the time, the most potent imperial power on the world, Prussian mercenaries marching through New England, one of the largest armadas ever formed by the British to shell and then occupy New York. But revolutions are internal affairs that pit citizen against citizen. They have a different dynamic. And in fact, although violence can be part of a revolution, successful revolutions are fundamentally nonviolent. Because, as the great theorists of revolution, Crane Brinton and Davies and others, have pointed out, no revolution is successful until significant elements of internal security defect or refuse to protect a discredited regime. We saw that in the Russian Revolution with the Petrograd bread riots. The Cossacks arrived, the enforcers of the Tsar, and refused to fire on the crowd. They rushed the Tsar back from the front, and he abdicated in a railway carriage. When the Shah fled Iran in 1979, one of the most well-equipped, well-trained, sophisticated military machines in the Middle East would no longer defend his discredited regime. This was true in Cuba when Bautista fled. It was true in Nicaragua when Somoza fled. It was true in East Germany when Erich Honecker sent down an elite paratroop division to Leipzig to fire on the crowd, and they refused. Honecker lasted as well another week in power. The secret of successful revolution is embodied in Václav Havel's great 1978 essay, The Power of the Powerless. The secret of successful revolution is living in truth and speaking that truth to power and pulling huge numbers of people into the streets nonviolently to discredit that power. The Stasi state was the most sophisticated security and surveillance state in the world until our own. And yet, once the foot soldiers of the elite tasked with the role of protecting that elite would no longer use coercion, even that regime was finished. Anyone who has read climate change reports understands that we have no time left. March saw every single day of the month at 440 parts per million in terms of carbon emissions. The first time that's happened since we began recording weather patterns. Scientists have reported from the Arctic that the measurement of the sea ice is completely off because the layers of old ice are gone. And the rate of evaporation of the new ice is far more accelerated. Corporate forces, which have seized every institution, the media, academia, the political system, the courts, will drive internally and exploit eternally until there is nothing left. Corporate capitalism, as Karl Marx understood, is a revolutionary force, and it is our job to break it, and if we do not break it, my children and your children will not have a future. The moment is grave and serious, and we can rely on no one now but ourselves. Rebellion is an act of faith. It does not ask what is practical. It does not ask, finally, even if it can succeed. In moments of what Immanuel Kant called radical evil, it requires an almost mystical belief that we are called to do the good, or at least the good insofar as we can determine it, and then let it go with the belief that the good goes somewhere. We do not know where. The Buddhists call it karma. It requires what the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr calls sublime madness. And Niebuhr said that in moments of extremity, liberalism is too weak and intellectual and ineffectual a force to counter radical evil. These corporate forces, in theological terms, are forces of death, and we are called to affirm the forces of life. There are windows into the world, the dystopian world that these corporations seek to create. One of them is our system of mass incarceration. We hold 25% of the world's prison population. We are 5% of the world's population. And most of those in our prisons are poor people of color, half of whom never committed violent offenses. As you heard in the introduction, I teach in a maximum security prison. And what's heartbreaking, and the reason I don't go back to do visiting professorships in universities, is that in every class I teach, I find students who have more brilliance, more passion for learning, more curiosity, more honesty, and finally more integrity than in any classroom I have taught in, including places like Princeton. And yet they never had a chance. Many of them will die in prison reading Augustine or Plato.
You've been listening to Chris Hedges. I was asked this afternoon while walking down the street, a gentleman came over and said, Gary, I have a question for you. I hear you talk on these social issues as well as health issues, and I don't know how to connect with it. I'm just not feeling like somehow what I will do will make a difference in this world. Look around you. There's just too many people who are making so much money and enjoying power. Rightly or wrongly, how can I as an individual change any of that? And I thought for a moment, and I said to this man, whose name is Eric, I said, Eric, one man, out of pure frustration, feeling as if his life no longer counted, set himself on fire in Tunisia. That caused people to say, what happened? And then there was a lawyer, a young lawyer in his 30s, who couldn't practice law. He didn't have the political connections, so he was forced to sell fruits and vegetables, making a few dollars a day, to afford bread and meat for his family in Egypt. There were others like him, but they had never joined together. They never saw the power of what Chris Hedges was just discussing, the power of unity, the power of the powerless. That created the Arab Spring. Now think for a moment. The Arab Spring lasted in its full dynamic for about 2.5 years. At the beginning, back in 2011, we were seeing people meet in a square in Egypt, and first a few hundred, then thousands. But it was not about religion. It was not about challenging Islam or supporting it. In fact, the Muslim Brotherhood, who were the most extremist of the beliefs, weren't even a part of it initially. They were there because they were hungry. They were starving. They had no jobs. They could not afford an education. There was massive unemployment. On top of that was police brutality, torture, waterboarding, killing people, extrajudicial killings. And you could not speak against the Mubarak regime. He had been in power for 30 years, receiving billions of dollars from the United States. All American presidents, going back through Ronald Reagan, had supported the tyranny of the dictatorship because it was not a democracy. He was not elected based upon having a real election. He was a dictator. And around him, he surrounded himself with the military. Coming from the military, it was just the military. So when the people protested, and there was that moment when the military could have moved against the people, instead it supported the people, Mubarak had to resign because he no longer had the support of the military. Then in came the Muslim Brotherhood, and then they started protesting. And then initially the government says, we will not fight you. In fact, several of the generals got up on tanks and said, you will never see us raise our guns against Egyptian citizens. That didn't last long. And then the clashes began again. And now the Muslim Brotherhood and their leader, Morsi, became the top person, had an election and won. And then immediately wanted the country to become a theocracy and with Sharia law and became as bad as the Mubarak government. In fact, many of the demonstrators and activists felt even worse. So now they had no freedom. They didn't have a constitution. When it was written to make Morsi a pharaoh. In fact, he was called the new pharaoh. Absolute power, and no one could challenge it. Finally, the military threw him out of power, then took over power, and that's where they are today. But imagine this. From there, all across Bahrain and other countries began to realize there is power in the people if they join together in protest. So I said, right now in the United States, we simply do not have enough starving people. We're not in enough pain. We are trapped in the prisons of our cell phones, our world, our internets, our televisions. We're not even aware we are prisoners and of our culture, of our conditioning, of our comforts. We live in a nation where we're morbidly obese and do not complain about that, nor the suffering of people from the diseases that we create, nor the people who provide us with the opportunity to become sick. So we're not ready for any form of revolution. So Chris is right. He is the right person with the right message at the wrong time with the wrong support system. and in the wrong place. So nothing will be done. Chris will go around the country giving us talks, deep, insightful, meaningful. But there will be no change. Not now, not when all the students should join together and protest, but they won't. They'll Twitter together. They'll share minutia together. They'll get drunk and binge together. They'll do drugs together. But they won't stand together. It tells you a lot about the character of an entire generation and their real desires. So we can't even get a quorum together about what we need to do to go forward. So it's not the right time. It'll probably happen when there's some cataclysmic natural event that upsets the entire balance of power. Now let's hear from two gentlemen who were having a conversation about this in a film back in 1981 called My Dinner with Andre. It's only 6 minutes long. A very interesting clip. Please listen in.
I mean, why is that? I mean, is it just because people are lazy today or they're bored? I mean, are we just like bored, spoiled children who've just been lying in the bathtub all day, just playing with their plastic duck, and now they're just thinking, well, what can I do? Okay, yes, we are bored. We're all bored now. But has it ever occurred to you, Wally, that the process that creates this boredom that we see in the world now may very well be a self-perpetuating, unconscious form of brainwashing created by a world totalitarian government based on money, and that all of this is much more dangerous than one thinks? And it's not just a question of individual survival, Wally, but that somebody who's bored is asleep, and somebody who's asleep will not say no? See, I keep meeting these people. I mean, just a few days ago, I met this man whom I greatly admire. He's a Swedish physicist, Gustav Bjornstrand, and he told me that he no longer watches television, he doesn't read newspapers, and he doesn't read magazines. He's completely cut them out of his life because he really does feel that we're living in some kind of Orwellian nightmare now, and that everything that you hear now contributes to turning you into a robot. When I was at Findhorn, I met this extraordinary English tree expert who had devoted his life to saving trees. Just got back from Washington, lobbying to save the redwoods. He's 84 years old. He always travels with a backpack because he never knows where he's going to be tomorrow. And when I met him at Findhorn, he said to me, "Where are you from?" And I said, "New York." He said, "Ah, New York, yes, that's a very interesting place. Do you know a lot of New Yorkers who keep talking about the fact that they want to leave but never do?" And I said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "Why do you think they don't leave?" I gave him different banal theories. He said, "Oh, I don't think it's that way at all." He said, "I think that New York is the new model for the new concentration camp, where the camp has been built by the inmates themselves, and the inmates are the guards, and they have this pride in this thing they've built. They've built their own prison, and so they exist in a state of schizophrenia, where they are both guards and prisoners, and as a result, they no longer have, having been lobotomized, the capacity to leave the prison they've made or to even see it as a prison." And then he went into his pocket and he took out a seed for a tree and he said, "This is a pine tree." He put it in my hand and he said, "Escape before it's too late." See, actually for 2 or 3 years now, Chiquita and I have had this very unpleasant feeling that we really should get out. That we really should feel like Jews in Germany in the late 30s. Get out of here. Of course, the problem is where to go, because it seems quite obvious that the whole world is going in the same direction. See, I think it's quite possible that the 1960s represented the last burst of the human being before he was extinguished, and that this is the beginning of the rest of the future now, that from now on there'll simply be all these robots walking around, feeling nothing, thinking nothing, and there'll be nobody left almost to remind them that there once was a species called a human being with feelings and thoughts, and that history and memory are right now being erased, and soon nobody will really remember that life existed on the planet. Now, of course, Bjornstrand feels that there's really almost no hope, and that we're probably going back to a very savage, lawless, terrifying period. Findhorn people see it a little differently. They're feeling that there'll be these pockets of light springing up in different parts of the world, and that these will be, in a way, invisible planets on this planet. And that as we, or the world, grow colder, We can take invisible space journeys to these different planets, refuel for what it is we need to do on the planet itself, and come back. And it's their feeling that there have to be centers now where people can come and reconstruct a new future for the world. And when I was talking to Gustav Bjornstrand, he was saying that actually these centers are growing up everywhere now. And that what they're trying to do, which is what Findhorn was trying to do, and in a way, what I was trying to do, I mean, these things can't be given names, but in a way, these are all attempts at creating a new kind of school or a new kind of monastery. And Bjornstrand talks about the concept of reserves, islands of safety, where history can be remembered and the human being can continue to function in order to maintain the species through a dark age. In other words, we're talking about an underground, which did exist in a different way during the Dark Ages among the mystical orders of the church. And the purpose of this underground is to find out how to preserve the light, life, the culture, how to keep things living. You see, I keep thinking that what we need is a new language. A language of the heart. Languages in the Polish forest where language wasn't needed. Some kind of language between people that is a new kind of poetry. That's the poetry of the dancing bee that tells us where the honey is. And I think that in order to create that language, you're going to have to learn how you can go through a looking glass into another kind of perception where you have that sense of being united to all things. And suddenly, you understand everything.
That was a clip from My Dinner with Andre. Now, mind you, that clip is old, 1981. But think of what they were saying then about people being bored, people looking for distraction, people not realizing they're in a prison. How many people do you hear talk about they don't like where they're living, yet they won't leave? And how many people move to New York for happiness? How many people move here for health? Because New York is not a city for health and happiness. It is a city to succeed. There's great culture, great minds here. But almost all the people that I've met who are successful here, and I've had my office for years, decades, up on the Upper West Side, the most concentrated area in the world of successful artists, educators, business people, great thinkers. They try to make their success in New York so they can have a place outside of it or an exclusive area of it. And they all want to get back to a farm or to the ocean or to the mountains. But rarely do they, because you get tied up in it. What I want to do now is I want to be able to share some music with you. And this music is based upon connecting with our inner energy, our inner voice. Because I see so many people, so many doctors, so many patients, so many people in the health field who are sick. The doctors are sick, the nurses are sick, the system is sick, and yet it has all the power and gives none to any other. It is jealous of anything else. And I believe that it's time that we took a look at our own innate healing capacity, our own capacity to resolve issues by realizing we're smarter than we have been led to believe or think. We should not automatically give away the power to make important choices to everyone who has a degree or is considered more successful than we are. And recently, just today, I played a clip from a woman at a TED conference who was terminally ill. And the doctors gathered her family around saying she only had a few hours to live. And she was being kept alive even though she was only 85 pounds and had massive sores. She had lymphoma, tumors all over her body. And her systems were closing down. Her organ systems were closing down. So it was only a matter of minutes till death. And she was in a coma at that moment. Yet she said she was completely clear. She could hear and understand everything. And she was not afraid. She said that she was able to communicate with her past father and her past brother. She said she saw the people there and understood their feelings. She said the desperation of the doctors who were putting tubes in her brother who was trying to get there from another country, and she was in Hong Kong. He was in India, and he was afraid he would make it before she passed. And in that moment, she said, it came to her. She saw the world as if it were 360-degree view. She understood everything, and she understood the meaning of her life and the purpose of her life. And therefore, she was not ready to forsake her life because she hasn't lived an authentic life. And hence, she came back out of her coma. She awakened, and she started immediately to regain her organs' strength. And within a few weeks, she was out of the hospital. In a few months, she had no cancer in her body. Hence, she was standing in front of a crowd in San Francisco at a TED conference telling her story. Now, medicine will not understand this, nor nursing, nor public health, nor scientists. They'll try to look for the electron, the proton, the neutron, the cell, the atom, the gene that caused this. It was none of the above. It was her life force, the one thing that we do not study because we don't understand it, because it would challenge the idea that we're just organic or inorganic matter. We're just a composition of minerals from burnout stars, that we have no living essence. And of course, the only thing that's missing when you die is your life energy. And yet, it's never on the death certificate, death by loss of life energy. It's always by cancer or gunshot or heart attack or such. So I believe that our journey to healing begins with our journey of affirming our right to an authentic life. I've counseled a lot of people who are dying, and all of them had the same thing. They felt that they wanted another chance to live, or even though they didn't believe they could live, but they regretted not living an authentic life. They worked hard. They were noble. They were thoughtful. They were conscientious. They just never lived their authentic life. They lived the life they were told to live. Hence, going back to my dinner with Andre, prisoners, without being aware that you're building the prison that you will then guard yourself in. So let us now feel something that comes with the energy and the vibration from anyone in every place. Feel this energy and see if it moves you to take a little journey inside. I'm Gary Noll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour.
Let me hear the worshipers! Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go. It's too hard.